right, welcome back to the Nexus Podcast. Joining me today is Abel Archundia. Abel is the Chief Technology Officer and Global Head of Advisory for Istari. We're going to talk about some key issues impacting critical infrastructure sectors today, focusing largely on things like complexity of OT and other environments and how it's affecting companies' resilience and really their ability to stand up to cyber attacks. So this is going to be an interesting, wide-ranging discussion, I think, and I've definitely been looking forward to it for a while now. Before we start, I want to thank you all again for listening. If you haven't subscribed yet, please do. We're on every major platform, from Apple Podcasts to Spotify to Amazon and beyond. So subscribing is really the best way to keep up with the guests I have and to be informed when there's a new episode. So thanks again for listening. Really appreciate it. So let's get the episode started and bring in Abel. How are you? Thank you so much for making the time. I appreciate it.
A pleasure, Michael. I'm really excited to join you in this podcast. I'm excited to join a Nexus event. Thank you to our listeners, to your listeners, for this platform and this opportunity. I mean, it's a topic and a company that I'm very passionate about. So to have a chance to speak to you and your audience about a topic that I've been dealing with for a couple of decades now, everyone of this conversation counts. So
right. Well, actually, it's a good place to start. Maybe if you could just kind of bring us up to speed on your background, because you've had a pretty diverse experience, as you said, the last couple of decades. And
that's charitable. That's a charitable way to put it. So let me start by saying I could compare scars with a lot of the colleagues in the audience. And the last 20 some years, I've been a head of IT, an IT person, a CIO in global pharma. And in the pharmaceutical companies I've been at, which are Sandoz Hexal, which is a division of Novartis, and then Bayer Pharma, and prior to that, a couple of other companies. These are regulated industries with vast operational estates. And at Novartis, for example, I was head of IT for TechOps, which had me in oversight of about 73 plants. Over diverse pharmaceutical technology. Equally at Bayer, this was very complex, life-saving technology. And then other two aspects of my career have been as a strategy consultant with BCG, doing strategy work and PowerPoint. And I was a P&L leader for Dell in Latin America, specifically in Mexico, big business. So my perspective of the topic is varied. I've been on the buy side, on the sell side, I've been on the down and I've been on the up. I'm happy to share that experience, which is global in nature and spans a couple of decades.
Yeah, I mean, pharma is just fascinating to me. And I mean, it really fits into the discussion because, you know, there's enormous complexity in all of these environments today. And I'd love to get just kind of your big picture thoughts on, you know, what's creating it. Is it strictly a too much technology question, or, you know,
let's start
talk about complexity.
Yeah, let's start there, because I do think that complexity is the word that comes to mind. I mean, a few words that come to mind are complex, regulated, critical. These are things that are and you know, fundamental to the way that we live. I mean, to the modern world and the way that we deliver medicine and the way that we go about our lives. I mean, for example, my child this morning, he's a young man, calls up and he has a fever. It's the second day he has a fever. Sometime back, not that far back, moms and dads around the world would be terrified if their child has 3 days of a fever, right? These days, you give them, you have a range of medicine that you can give these kids. You always trust the drug when you give it to them. You don't second guess. It's not something that puts you out of your balance when your child has fever. You pop up an ibuprofen, you'll be fine. If it gets really bad, you give them an antibiotic. If it gets really bad, you go to the hospital and they'll plug in an IV. All of this is made possible thanks to that complexity, to that dedication to science, to that criticality that countless thousands of people make happen, and it's largely invisible to all of us until we go to the pharmacy, right? I have worked hand by hand, shoulder to shoulder, with colleagues over the last two decades in research, development, drug discovery, drug launching, manufacturing, and distribution that makes that little miracle happen around the world for millions and millions of patients. So I'm very passionate about the life-saving nature of the work that pharma does. So complexity comes now being business-oriented and very practical. The majority of these pharma companies were not born yesterday. I mean, some of them, biotechs, may be even born during the COVID era. But the majority are venerable institutions that started doing science 100 years ago, 70 years ago, 120 years ago. And they have accumulated technology and industrial assets over literally the centuries. I remember at Bayer Pharma, I had a lot of pride that my first office was in the original office that Dr. Schering had in the early part of last century. Mm-hmm. And this is at the core. This technology accumulates. So when you're a new IT guy or a new cybersecurity person walking into a situation like this, I mean, the legacy that you encounter is monumental from an achievement standpoint, but it's also expressed in countless vats, machinery, packaging lines, production lines that are cavernous, that are old, that have been producing 24/7 for the last 3 or 4 decades. And then you have to make secure. Just picture that environment, right? I mean, there's tens of thousands of devices that have been adding up over the years, and they have become digital. So you now have all kinds of software assets that are piling up on top of others and that produce data sets, some of which are very sensitive. And I would say that these are the three levers of complexity that the technical person has to deal with. These mm-hmm. are technical assets that are data assets, devices, and software assets, processes or embedding processes that you have to assemble in coherent and validate the processes to deliver medicine every day.
So, I mean, this is technical debt we're talking about. And I mean, where is it coming from? I mean, is it, I'm sure like M&A activity, and I guess more importantly, what does it lead to? I mean, this complexity, is it introducing risk or is it just a day-to-day process kind of impediment?
There you go. I think that you use that two terms that are very central to the day-to-day of anyone in manufacturing or industrial estates. There's certainly a lot of merger and acquisition activity in operations and manufacturing, industrial estates, in pharma as well. And you can ask colleagues that work in pharmaceuticals. They sometimes have had 7 or 8 different entities that have paid their payroll over their careers. People typically stay in place, but the companies and the logos change a lot. That is clearly it's part of the economics of the industry. And that results in what you aptly call technical debt. The reality is that when you are dressing up a company for sale or looking at a company to be acquired, typically business management does not invest in state-of-the-art or evergreening or rip and replace technologies. They try to milk out and eke out as much as possible from the assets they have. And that results in assets that are operational for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, including software assets. And that, I mean, that just doesn't keep up with the latest generation of technology things. Think about software assets that are used, for example, to do the planning of a shift in manufacturing. So when you are doing the manufacturing planning, the manufacturing execution systems, these may be software assets that are 20 or 25 years old that were installed during the time of the MRPs, DRPs, even before ERPs were common. Then mm-hmm. maybe there was a massive SAP effort that replaced some of these manufacturing execution systems or manufacturing resource planning systems. And then just these have to adapt to processes. Imagine a tablet compressor that has been around for literally 10 or 12 years or 15 or 20. And there's a software layer, there's a physical layer, and then underneath that physical layer, there could be multiple layers of SCADA systems or PLCs, actuators, valves that are operating in concert in what people in the industry call a validated process that certifies that the next time that you're going to produce that pill in the same, given the same environmental considerations, the pill will have a certain content of a content of the active ingredient, for example, aspirin. And then that whenever your child pops in that ibuprofen, the active ingredient that is going to get them healthy will be the same. I mean, you could say the same thing for the way that you package and bottle Coca-Cola or the way that you do any kind of consumer packaged good. You have a certain specification, a bill of materials, a process that follows that specification, a software that allows you to modify it within parameters, and then off you go. All of that complexity gets you the product or the that you're expecting at the end of the line, but it's a product of a global supply chain that has dozens of participants and tremendous complexity, to use the term again.
I mean, it sounds like it's impossible to pay down that technical debt, whatever that might mean. What's your experience there?
Well, every manufacturing installation, every industrial asset has a so-called capital investment plan, which mm-hmm. which is a holy book, right? I mean, you have it. It's typically contemplating investments that are depreciated down. It's typically a financial decision. And that lasts from anywhere from 5, 7, or 10 years, depending on the industry that you're at. And in some occasions, these plants get completely refurbished every decade or so. In other cases, it could be longer or shorter, depending on the industry. So for example, automotive plants that have a very fast or relatively faster product life cycle, then you end up doing refresh every 3 years. If you're doing aspirin, maybe you can afford to depreciate down your assets over 15 to 20 years. And that's typically when manufacturing leadership plans a refresh. And then you do a refresh of the physical assets, an automation of the production lines, an upgrade of the software processes that are supervising that manufacturing. And that is a fantastic opportunity to also refresh the resiliency and the cybersecurity stance of such an asset. So that's when you pay down that technical debt. But the reality for the majority of our listeners is that they walk into a situation where they have to operate in a context of what I would call a brownfield. That's the term that we use every year. You see what assets you're going to have to, you know, live with to manage the best you can. Which assets can you replace this year? And these are typically software assets. And then which are the devices or the processes that you just want to maintain? I would say that one thing I'm excited about is that increasingly preventive maintenance, so trying to correct a potential issue in advance of a failure, is an opportunity for people to really act and patch software, upgrade the capabilities of the software layer, the digital layer of the manufacturing, which is really giving effectiveness and efficiency results with a much higher return on the investment versus the physical layer. So you can count me on the field of the converts. I am very much an advocate for digital manufacturing and investing in the digital capabilities of the manufacturing facility.
It also sounds like, too, that these manufacturing enterprises, they have such a large footprint. And I know you mentioned this kind of in a discussion we had before our podcast today, that, you know, some of these organizations might feel outmatched by the technical debt. I mean, how overwhelming is this?
Well, I mean, I think that I'm not going to lie. I mean, some days you want the meeting is over, people walk out of the room, or the Zoom is over, and then you sit there and you're looking at the blank wall, or you have this, you know, this, right. This, and they're like, oh my God, you know, we all have experienced this. I'm sure that people in the audience sympathize. I have never seen leadership in manufacturing throw their hands up in despair. I mean, maybe you develop a thick skin. I mean, yes, that's true. But then I think that one thing that you would find in manufacturing is that operators have a thick skin and they have a hard helmet on their heads. So we are used to working under stress, working under pressure with shoestring resources. So you find a way. And I find that it is a team sport. I think manufacturing teams in general, my experience of working shoulder to shoulder with operators, there aren't a lot of politics. And the reason is that the on-time in full, OTIF, service levels are a pretty cardinal rule and a cardinal metric for the majority of the people in manufacturing. You know that you have to ship those goods. In the case of pharma, shipping those goods is a life-saving endeavor. When you're in oncology injectables, you know that if you're not meeting service levels, patients are going to go without your life-saving drug. And that is something that got me out of bed every day, every week, without fail. When you think that you have to make sure that the life-saving drug that your plant is producing gets shipped out, I tell you, that galvanizes your spirit and you go for it. Lately, I've seen the IT people in the plants, the people who have digital responsibilities, have a voice at the table, have a seat at the table, and increasingly be our eye-level partners to plant leadership that are taken very much into consideration for decisions. I think that there are a number of functions that were maybe a little bit undervalued in the previous decades. I mean, think about supply chain, IT itself, vendor management. Over the last decade, these functions, vendor management, supply chain, and information technology, have really gotten a prominence, deservedly so, in the manufacturing space that gives us an added opportunity as well as increased responsibility to make sure that life-saving drug, that those on-time in full metrics are achieved. Because if you think about it, if you take a step back, many of these companies are now using contract manufacturing for a significant high double-digit portion of their activities. Vendors are increasingly responsible, even in the plant, for critical processes. And all of these are brought together by information technology capabilities. So all of us, these three functions, to name a few, are now able to play a role, not only participating, but even orchestrating the way that manufacturing addresses the challenges that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of the things I really enjoy about working in the space and meeting people on the front line, so to speak, is that their priorities are patient safety, are uptime, are, you know, plant safety, and not just, you know, patching servers or making sure your desktop is up to date. There's a tangible physical outcome and to a lot of the work that the folks that we deal closely with are doing every day. It's something I really enjoy about this.
Spot on, Michael. I think that you bring up a topic which allows me to make a small detour. Sure. You talked about safety. I think that health and safety, HSI indicators, are for the majority of the plants that I always work with, oil and gas, pharmaceuticals, automotive, health and safety indicators are equally important to on-time in full indicators. Recently, these health and safety indicators, health and safety can be expressed as a risk, and these include cybersecurity. Because think about it, cybersecurity and the convergence of IT and OT has created a really big opportunity for attackers, for malicious actors, to take a shot at slowing down, stopping, or getting ransom in the manufacturing space, right? So over the last 4 years, I've worked with Clarity. I'm a board member at Clarity, and I've been working to address what I saw as a looming challenge, and it really panned out over the last 3 years. Manufacturing has now replaced financial services as the top attacked industry. Attackers are coming at industry both in frequency and impact with a diligence that is only matched by the profits they make. The reality is that these twin indicators of health and safety and on time in full are so powerful that the majority of the outmatched IT security teams in the plants, well, I mean, I see that they just pay. I mean, and I can tell right. you a dozen examples from Merck to Maersk to Honda to Norsk Hydro to the city of Baltimore. You know, how many examples do you want of water facilities, colonial pipelines, pharmaceutical companies that have been brought to their knees by an unwanted intruder that is imperiling the service levels, the operations, the stability, the uptime of a plant. And standards are following, and manufacturing follows the standards. Those standards are evolving, and the regulation in OT is changing to ensure that resilience is met. And I think this is an increased responsibility for the enterprise listener that we have. So the enterprise CISO that is maybe in your audience listening to this podcast, this is now the uncharted territory. Now you are it. The plant leadership is looking at the enterprise IT for guidance that is consistent with what they have dealt with for the last few years, and how does that apply to critical infrastructure. And these are steep walls to climb, right?
Sure. Yeah, you mentioned regulation too there as part of this, and I know that that drives a lot of business decisions. Are you seeing that dynamic where it creates kind of competing interests between plant owners and business leaders around regulation and what's expected there?
Let's unpack a little bit your question, because I think that there's two aspects here. First, anyone in critical infrastructure, certainly in manufacturing, we do look at maybe 10 or 12 regulatory frameworks that we need to be compliant with. Nobody in manufacturing wants to be out of compliance for good reason, right? I mean, there's all kinds of standards for good practices that have to be followed. And I haven't met many people that are really willingly cutting corners. We may be falling behind certain regulation. We may be coming up short because our processes are not so mature or our capabilities are not great. But I never found, well, I won't say never, but you will hardly find people that intentionally are cutting corners. I mean, yes, we have to make trade-offs. I don't think that those trade-offs are wrongly directed, especially not with people who are working in life sciences. However, it is tough to keep up with so many regulations. I mean, let me just rattling out a few. There's IECs, there's ISO, there's NIST, there's good manufacturing practices, there's GXP, there's validation, there's NIST. There's a dozen regulation and regulatory frameworks that you have to be compliant with. So for cash-strapped leadership, the question is, what do we do first? And then what the responsible IT leader has to do is we have to really speak the language of the financial leadership that is helping coach the P&L owner to make better decisions. We cannot just say, look, you need to do this because it's mandated by compliance. I think we need to find, I mean, it's incumbent upon us to be able to find business arguments as to why complying or even going beyond compliance will give us a competitive advantage. I personally, although I had maybe 20%, 25% of my projects historically were driven out of compliance and regulation. Oftentimes it was the majority of the times it was to make sure that I was meeting compliance at the time that it became enforceable. It rarely was that I was trying to catch up with compliance. I was trying to meet compliance, whether it was in California, in the European Union, or in Singapore, or in China. Oftentimes, a large part of my job was to keep in sync competitive advantage, like discretionary projects that would give me a strategic advantage, with enterprise efforts that needed to be executed across the estate, including, for example, a rollout of a new Windows device or a new operating system. across 20 or 30,000 endpoints, and compliance and regulation across the world. And so it was like keeping a dozen trains running more or less in parallel and in time, so that, because you also don't want to invest in compliance ahead of its due time, because the market will not recognize that. Compliance and regulation follows a rhythm that is dictated by market needs. So you need to understand what are those drivers and stay in sync with those drivers, and to mm-hmm. see where applying that compliance will give you competitive advantage. That's how I framed it. Now, when I was in generics, in the generics drug manufacturing, the cost competitiveness was the primary goal. So you are always trying to stick as close as possible to compliance, so that you are not investing a cent above what you must to be able to give adequate drugs to your patients, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think that all of the competitors did that all the time. And that was, for me, a potential competitive advantage, because someone that was operating under a warning letter or that a regulator caught cheating would be out of operations for a couple of years. And that just set back the investor and the plant for a while. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You mentioned your conversation about compliance. Are we doing a better job? Are you seeing enterprises doing a better job kind of getting away from that mentality of compliance equals a secure environment, for example, and that, you know, maybe it really should be kind of a minimum standard and built upon?
What a great point. So I have to say that all of what I said about compliance and competitive advantage applies mostly to business efforts, but not necessarily to cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. And in particular, when you think about cybersecurity, the reality is that the attacker sets the pace of what we should be doing, not the regulator. The regulator is oftentimes unaware of the latest vectors that the attacker follows. I hope that your audience have stayed with us so far, because I don't want to give the impression that compliance and regulation equals secure operations from a cybersecurity threat perspective. Not at all. My experience is that regulation is probably 5 to 7 years behind what the attacker does. And I think that the responsible leader in IT has to look at operations in critical infrastructure and continually assess the vectors of threat, the vectors of risk, and the vectors of compliance to find the right balance. And you have to triangulate, is this plant in the radar for an attacker, and which are the assets that I need to produce? Is this plant on the vector of regulation, and what do I need to do to stay compliant? Mm-hmm. And lastly, is this plant on the vector of safety, and what do I need to do to ensure service levels and safety standards? So I think at the core of this, there's data. At the core of this, there's awareness. And what is unacceptable today is to not know. You know, I think that companies like Clarity provide visibility and asset recognition, which makes it unacceptable to not know, right? I mean, I think that the majority of our clients as Clarity, the majority of the, I'm an investor in Clarity, but so that's why I speak with some degree of commitment to that company. The majority of the industry has now moved on from visibility into prioritization. I would say that the stage of awareness and asset discovery, that's maybe 3 to 5 years behind us. The stage of full visibility of the estate, I think that's maybe 2 to 3 years behind us. And that includes cloud assets, so primarily cloud delivered, cloud sourced capabilities for the critical infrastructure. And we are now at the stage where what you want is to really prioritize what do you do given the latest dynamics of risks or threats in your landscape. And a risk-led resilience roadmap is what I encourage everybody in the industry to do. I mean, if you find yourself still segmenting your networks and installing firewalls and changing passwords in your firewalls, well, it's very likely that you need to also invest in crisis readiness, because you can be you can find yourself in a crisis dealing with an attacker and a ransomware very, very soon. So you need to get that Bitcoin wallet ready.
You know, that's a great point, and it kind of leads into a final question here, because I know we're coming up on time. But just, you know, we tell companies, enterprises all the time to assume that they've been breached, or, you know, eventually they'll be breached. Do you think we spend enough time telling them how to recover? And you know, and again, just kind of related, how much does this atmosphere of complexity impede their ability to be proactive about security and think about, you know, recovery plans and planning ahead, like you said, a Bitcoin wallet is, for example.
So one of the colleagues that I respect the most in my company, as you said, I work for Istari, which is an investor, an educator, and an advisor. One of my colleagues, Manuel Heppner, he's a researcher with us. He's a thought leader in this space, and he's done some amazing research. And yesterday, I was having a conversation with him about NIST and NIST2. And he turns red to his ears in that NIST and NIST2 are really weighted into identify and detect, and only 20% of the controls are really orientated to recover and respond. And I think that that reflects that mindset that you're talking about. Of course, up until now, we've been really, as I said, in the stage of awareness, discovery, visibility, prioritization. I think that the optimal setup follows what the nuclear plants and Manuel pushes in our industry as the bow tie model. I mean, you need to assume that there's going to be, that there's a possibility of a boom somewhere, and that you need to take some activities before the boom and after the boom. And in the case of cybersecurity, you have to assume a breach. And then how will you recover? How recent are your backups? To what extent can you trust them? When was the last time that you tested your disaster recovery plan? I mean, being fully transparent here, at one of my previous employers, I had a plan to do 3 DRP executions per year across of state that had dozens of plants. I oftentimes only got to do 2 of the 3 that I intended, because doing a DRP is a massive exercise that is very costly, and you really have to jump into the cold water, and what you find is very hard to assume. So if you assume a breach and you test your capabilities, you're going to find yourself testing your crisis management team, your communication protocols, your technical protocols, your backup and recovery systems, your recovery points. You will find some nasty things about your recovery options. And you know, when you go to that data center to switch off the switch, the master switch, I mean, I never did it with confidence. Never did it with confidence. And I knew that I was putting my career on the line every time that I did it. But I knew that if I did not do it, my career was on the line anyways. If that makes sense. So I think companies like Clarity and other companies certainly in our portfolio as investors are increasingly putting their eyesight into recovering from a bad day in cyber. And I think that it's really, this needs to go to the board. It needs to go to the executive leadership team. It needs to go to brand leadership as something that is very real and happening. If it's not happening in your plant, it's happening down the road. And if it's not happening in your plant, it's just because you've been lucky. I can't think of a responsible CISO or CIO that hasn't really seriously contemplated a breach event in the last 18 months, Michael. It's something we need to take as an assumption of the way that we work.
Agreed. I think that's a huge point. All right, Abel, I want to thank you so much for sharing all this amazing information. I think this has been an important conversation, and I'm really glad that it happened.
I'm glad to have been invited, Michael. I hope to have earned a subsequent invitation in the future. Thank you to you and to your audience for staying with us. I hope that I didn't lose anyone because I'm really passionate about this topic and I can speak for hours about it. But reach out to Clarity or Istari for further commentary. And I hope to see you at Nexus later this year.
You will. You definitely will. All right. Thank you, Abel. Appreciate it.
Take care, Michael. Be well. Bye-bye.